This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. They're not going to call themselves that, but we can. Men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget. And along the way, not only are we educated and entertained, we're quite frequently inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear from a pretty good storyteller today, Alan Rasmussen of Fresno, California, a 92-year-old decorated combat medic from World War II. And you're going to hear me talk a little less today because sometimes he answers my questions before I even ask him. We'll hear some of his battlefield memories with the 71st Infantry Division, a couple encounters with General George S. Patton, and what Alan saw when his unit helped liberate a concentration camp in Gunskirchen, Austria. Like so many of the veterans you've heard from on this show, he wouldn't have met his wife if things hadn't gone just the way they did during World War II. And I know there are 3 kids, 6 grandkids, and 11 great-grandkids who are pretty thankful for that. Born in Applegate, California, near Auburn, he ended up going to schools all over Merced County as his family dealt with the Great Depression. He graduated from Merced High School in 1939, took the $269 he had saved up after 4 years of working after school, and he went to the University of California at Santa Barbara with the goal of becoming an industrial arts teacher. Santa Barbara is where he was on December 7th, 1941.
So we heard people talking out in the streets. We opened the window and looked out there. What's going on? She said, haven't you heard? No. She said, Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. Wow. That was Sunday. When Monday went to school, things were in uproar. Most of the fellows going to college there were on reserve, and Army, Navy, whatever, and so they started to leave right away. Well, I'd always wanted to be a pilot, to fly airplanes. So I went down to the local place where the Air Force office was. Oh, yeah, we want you. So they said, show up tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. We have a bus out here. We'll take you down to L.A. for induction. Great, I'm going to be a flyer. Get down, go through the induction. Went through with flying colors. Got to the eyesight. My eyesight was perfect, 20/20. He gave me this color chart, a little round circle, about 4 or 5 inches in diameter with pastel dots. Guy said, what do you see? I said, I see 69. No, he said, that's 88. Colorblind chart. I think the Japanese did that on purpose to kick me out of the service.
They didn't want any piece of you in the Pacific.
No. So I tried the Navy, same thing. So I went back to school and I hung in there. I wanted to quit, but I only had a little over half a semester done. So I talked to the teachers. Well, no, we can't give you a grade, not yet. So it lasted on into January, and I went up to visit with a friend of mine. He was up at his girlfriend's house. I went up there and walked in. Bill and his girlfriend were sitting there. So Bill said, what are you going to do, Al? I said, I'm going to go down to Los Angeles, see if I can find a place working in the aircraft plant. So the girl said, oh, my dad's home this weekend. And I heard a voice say next door, come on over here. So I went into the den. This gentleman was sitting there. He was probably in his late 40s, early 50s. Sit down. Okay, sat down. He said, I work at Northrop Aircraft. He said, you think you want to go work down there? I said, tell me about it. So he did. He asked me questions. Well, I'd industrial arts teacher in 2.5 years. I'd had sheet metal. I knew riveting. I could read blueprints of any kind. He thought, well, you're pretty well qualified. So he pulled a card out of his pocket, turned over, took a pen out of his pocket, and wrote something on the back of it. Handed it to me. Said, when you go down to Northrop, he said, get the personnel. He said, and whoever comes to the desk, hand it to him. So a week later, said to the gal at the desk, I'm looking for personnel. Right down the hall and on your right. So I headed down the hall, walked up the counter. A young lady stood up. How may I help you? I handed her the card. She held it in her hand and looked at it. And I said, turn it over, because I'd already looked on the back. The guy had written on the back, this is Alan Rasmussen. I know him. Hire him. Well, she read that. She took off in the back room. And out came the head of personnel. I had first-class treatment. He said something to the girl, and we sat in his office there and talked for about 15 minutes. He asked me all about my background, what I knew, et cetera, and so on. So after about 15, 20 minutes, he said, so you want to go to work, huh? I said, yep. He said, when? I said, tomorrow. Okay, he said, we need people on graveyard shift. That's 11:30 at night till 7:30 in the morning. That sounded good to me. I could take a girl out to show in the evening and get down there and change my clothes and be at work at 11:30 at night. That's fine. Morning, if I wanted to, I could get up, grab my swimsuit, put it on, head down for the beach and chase the girls up and down the beach. Ideal. So I went to work at Northrop graveyard shift. I went in, and the first thing they did was talk to me a bit, took me over where they were doing pickup work on the inner wing of an airplane. The inspectors inspect if there's bad rivets that have been, you know, not quite put in right. You have to drill them out and replace them. Well, I went to work there, and it was fun. No problem. So about a week or so later, the boss came out to DL. You know a lot about this stuff. Yeah, I said, I told you I was trained to be an industrial arts teacher. He said, we're going to move you up the rank a bit. So I moved to a little more advanced job. And by, October of 1943, I was a lead man running the line building the P-61 Black Widow. That was the first all-electronic fighter plane. Painted black, went out at night, got the Jap planes. So I had told the boss, I was running a crew of about 35 to 40 men and women by that time. Told the boss I want the best-looking girls on my crew.
So you had that kind of pull, huh?
Well, yeah, I was a lead man. So anyway, one morning, here the gal personnel comes down the hall, three young ladies with her. One of them was blonde, looked good. So I nudged one of the guys working. Said, "See that blonde over there? I'm going to marry her." "Oh, come on, Al." "No, I'm going to marry her." So sure enough, Norm took one girl over to another part, another one across from another place. Brought this little blonde over to me. He said, "Al," he said, "I got another worker for you here." He said, "Her name is Mildred Machula. She'll be working with you. Take good care of her." I said, "I will, Norm." So the Lord again had me and her in his hand. She came all the way from Canada above Minnesota with a girlfriend by train down to Los Angeles, and she came to work at Northrop. Now, again, the Lord has me in his hand. She was a good little worker. She would learn fast doing riveter. You all probably heard of Rosie the Riveter in World War II. Well, she was Rosie the Riveter.
Or Millie the Riveter, anyway.
Millie, well, yeah. So anyway, I was trying to get acquainted with her, and I'd visit with her at lunchtime and so forth. I called her Millie. Her girlfriend hated me. She didn't like that Millie name, but I called her Millie. I said to her one day, I said, "How about give me your phone number? I'll give you a call." "Nope." "Where do you live?" "Nope." Really playing hard to get. I thought, what am I going to do? Well, I went up to the counter, pulled out a little card box, pulled her card out, wrote her phone number down and address. If I did that day, I'd get put in jail probably. Anyway, so after work that night, I jumped in my car, went up, found where she lived, went down to the main street there, a little telephone booth out there. I gave her a call. "Hi, Millie." I said, "I just happened to be in the area on business." I didn't tell her it was monkey business. But I said, "I'd like to stop by and see you." "Well, you can stop by, but you can't come in." Well, I said, "We'll go bowling." "Okay." So I get up there, and she's all dressed up, and we went bowling. Well, and that day, in those days, there were so many people coming in from all over the United States to work in the war industry that we went to bowling. I went and had to wait an hour and a half for an alley. Well, we sat there and talked for a while, and we had to both get up early the next morning to go to work, so we went to a drive-in. Of course, we ordered the standard fare, you know, milkshake, hamburger, french fries. We were eating away, and she said, "Would you hand me a serviette?" I had no idea what a serviette was. So I was going to grab the whole tray and pull it in the car and give it to her. She said, "No, I mean one of those paper things there." She wanted the paper napkin. So I gave it to her. And I said, "What's the deal with that?" "Well," she said, "in Canada, a napkin or a nappy is a baby diaper. We call them serviettes." So anyway, we kept visiting, and she said she liked to dance, and I liked to dance. I decided to ask her if she'd go out and dance with me. She said, "Yes, I will." Saturday night, got down to her place about 8:30 in the evening to go down to Palladium, which is a big dance hall downtown Los Angeles. There's quite a few big dance halls, the Palladium, Trianon, Meadowbrook, Casmanana. Always had first name bands playing. So we went down to the Palladium, had a great time. But when she came to the door, when I went to pick her up, on her left finger, she had a big ring. Uh-oh, I said, I never said a word about it. So we went dancing Saturday after Saturday, and we were starting to get along pretty darn good. About the seventh or eighth time we went out, I said to myself, "She has that ring on. No use fighting it." So I told her that. I said, "Millie, if you have that ring on when I pick you up tomorrow night, why, I'm just going to go home and we'll still be friends. We go down and pick her up. She walked out, no ring. Well, she'd come in October. This was after Christmas. I said, you're not wearing the ring. Well, she said, my girlfriends wrote me letters and said that my boyfriend, who was in the Royal Canadian Air Force, had come home for a leave on Christmas time, and he was chasing the girls all over town. So I decided, well, enough of him. So we went along, and that was in after Christmas. Well, by about June, I decided I wanted to go into service. Well, Northrop and all the industry, war industry, had a ruling from the government that if a man was working for you in a job that was very necessary, he didn't have to go into service.
Yeah, so you could have enjoyed that exemption for a long time.
Yeah, So anyway, I knew they'd give me a bad time if I told them, so I was talking to the guy. He said, well, go down to the draft board. Maybe they can help you. So I went downtown. Lady was sitting by her desk in the corner. I walked in, being fairly outspoken. I said, hi, how you doing? I want to go into service. I work at Northrop. Oh, boy, they're hard to get away from. So we talked for a while. I said, well, I'll write a couple of letters, and maybe I can get you in. So a week and a half later, I get a letter in the mail, show up for induction. So I did. Went through, and it was amazing. I walked in the place. There were long lines, maybe 20, 30 fellows in the line. I had my papers in my hand. The guy said, let me see your papers. He looked at me, wrote something on. I said, go to the head of the line. Said, these guys have obviously been here for a long time. He said, well, it's a little different with you. What's that? See that color band across the top of your papers? I said, yep. He said, these guys are all draftees. You're a volunteer. You go to the head of every line here. So I got through there in a very short time. They hauled me down to an Army base south of L.A., shipped me up to Camp Roberts, California. When you go in, when you sign up and go through these, you write down what you're interested in. Well, I'd put down I was interested in shooting, rifles, et cetera, and so on. So they put me in a company that was training. They call them camp mechanics. We were taught to work with the weapons used in the infantry, to know how to take them apart, repair them, clean them, all that good stuff. I figured we're getting close to being shipped out, so we talked about marriage, and we decided to get married. So I got married a weekend. You couldn't leave camp on your pass until lunchtime on Saturday. Well, I went into the sergeant. Sorry, Al, he said, you know, he said, we can only leave 20% of the men off at any one time. And we had them, they're all got passed already. So who do I see in line next? Well, he said, I guess you can see the battalion commander. I said, may I have permission to see the battalion commander? He said, oh, go ahead. He laughed. But I got a head up there. He told me the same thing. So I said, who's the next man? He said, the regimental commander. I said, may I have permission to see the regimental commander? He started to laugh. He said, you are persistent. He wrote me a pass. Here you go. Go down. So I went. I left camp at 7 o'clock in the morning. First ride out with a woman officer and took me down, I think, Ventura or someplace. From there on down to L.A. and hitchhiked out, and we got married that evening. So then we had another weekend pass. Came back and passed. They had a big bulletin board outside the barracks with papers on it with list of who and where you're going. There was my name, Fort Meade, Maryland, with a date to get there.
And you'd get there after a week's honeymoon with Millie in Santa Barbara, and from Maryland they sent you to Fort Benning, Georgia to join the 71st Infantry Division as a rifleman. But that didn't sit well with you?
Well, I thought I'm going to look around for something else within the division.
Why was that? What didn't you like about a rifleman?
I didn't want to be a rifleman. I thought that there's other things there where I might learn more or something. So I'm talking about it, and I made a big boo-boo, though. Saturday morning, supply sergeant had a table out by his building there, and he had boxes with BARs, Browning Automatic Rifle. That's a hot weapon in the infantry, World War II. 20-round clip, fire semi-automatic or full-automatic. So he was trying to get one apart. Well, dummy, I walked over to the table. I said, hey, Sarge, I'll help you. So he spread all the parts out, cleaned them all up. They had cosmoline on them. It's an oil grease they put on when they ship them. Cleaned it all up, put it back together, and slammed the bolt down. It worked fine. So next morning at Reveille, Sergeant said, Rasmussen? Yes, sir. He said, BAR man. Oh, I didn't want a BAR man. BAR man's life was very short in the Pacific. The old Japs want to get rid of you in a hurry.
Yeah, you're a target because you're the heavy weapon.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm sort of thinking, what the heck am I going to do? Well, I was sitting out there talking to a buddy of mine. He said, Al, he said, they need a medic up in the aid station. Boy, I took off on almost dead run, got up there, walked in, permission to see the head guy, doctor, captain. So I said, I understand you need a medic. He said, yes, we do. So he started to ask me questions. Well, I'd been around the block. You know, I had physiology. I knew the body. I knew where all the pressure points were, where the arteries were, and all that kind of blown in. He said, okay. He said, I'll send a pass transfer down to your company for you. So I went to intensive training as a medic.
And it was as a medic that you shipped out from New York in late 1944.
I was a medic. We had Red Cross on our armbands and on our helmet. So we're going up the gangplank on the ship, and I was head of the line. So a guy put his arm down in front of me. He said, you and next 11 guys, follow me. Okay. We're all medics. So he took us out to the ship's medical bay. He said, I'm assigning you to work here for the crews. I thought, gee, work? I don't want to do that. It was the best thing that ever happened.
Why is that?
They had about 20 beds in there. We didn't have to go down and sleep down in that old bag bunk they had for us.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go steal food from the officer's mess. They put the stuff out in the companionway to thaw it out. So we cooked our own meals up there, and we had a good time.
Was it hard to leave and say goodbye to Millie and not know if you were going to see her again?
I can remember that to this day just as perfect as if I was standing there now. We went to LAX to the Army Air Base, was right parallel. And I went up to the fence, and the guard said, how can I help you? I said, I'm flying east. Got something going? So he called, yeah, I got a BT-13. So anyway, grabbed her and gave her a big old kiss, and they opened the gate and my duffel bag, and I left that lipstick on my mouth for as long as it stayed on there, and they washed it off. Oh, I forgot to tell you, when I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, I'd been in the Army about 2 months, I got a letter from her, and she said, honey, I'm pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get to see her for 21 months. Anyway, I'll finish that story.
We'll make sure you do, but it's break time for now. 92-year-old Alan Rasmussen of Fresno, California, our guest today. When we come back, some of his experiences as a combat medic. Also, what he's thankful to General George S. Patton for, and what it was that took Alan off the lines toward the end of World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 92-year-old Alan Rasmussen of Fresno, California. At the terraces at San Joaquin Gardens, where he's lived for over a decade, they call him Cowboy. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and I think you'll see why. Their other nickname for him there is the Hugger. In his years teaching industrial arts at Chowchilla High School and later Cappuccino High in San Bruno, they called him Mr. R. But during World War II, he answered to medic. Let's pick things up with his arrival in France with the 71st Infantry Division in late 1944.
They get us up in these tents, and it was muddy. The mud was about 6 inches deep. And so he got the rumor that Patton, General George Patton, was going to come down to look at our division. So the officers, bless their pointed heads, they had us all out there working. Had us medics out there digging ditches around this darn tent. Patton walked up, and he's a pretty rough character. He said to the colonel, chicken colonel, three-star general, it's like a master sergeant talking to a buck private.
Right.
He turned around, colonel, you know, what in the hell are these damn medics digging into this so-and-so mud? Well, colonel couldn't hardly talk. He was mumbling something. He said, colonel, if I take this division in my army, if I see any of your men working, you're going to be a private. Medics do not do this kind of work. You get them in a darn tent, and you teach them first aid so they'll know how to take care of those poor buggers that get hit, get wounded. Okay, so we never worked at anything like that again. That was my first meeting with Patton.
You have Patton to thank for that.
Oh, he was a great guy, I'll tell you. Patton's the greatest. He loved his men. Boy, if his guys, they never got in trouble because nobody else would mess with us, even the other officers.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, we were there for a few days. Then we hit the line. We went down, fought down to the Rhine River. First few days on combat is a whole different lifestyle. See, in World War II, less than 10% of the men and women in uniform actually saw combat. So if you were a combat soldier, you were a whole lot different than what you did. So we hit the line, and we learned a lot in those first few days. It was pretty exciting.
Were you scared?
No. No, I had the Lord. I knew he was taking care of me by that time. Because I had accepted Christ when I was working at Northrop. I didn't tell you that, but first, second, and third night I was working there, this young fellow named Bill Reed came up and sat by me and talked to me. He said, I attend a little church here in Hawthorne. He said, why don't you come down? A lot of young people have moved from all over the United States here, and you can get acquainted. So I did.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, I guess it was after maybe a month or so, the pastor did a real Billy Graham altar call. I don't know whether I flew or walked or crawled down, went down front and accepted Christ as my Savior. So all through this wartime, I had that.
What did that do for you? What kind of?
No fear.
No fear.
No fear.
Because you knew where you were going.
I knew where I was going.
I'm sure you had some concern for Millie and that baby that you were hoping you'd get to meet someday.
I'll tell you about that. remember the lady in the that talked to me and got in the army.
Right.
Remember her, okay? So anyway, we fought through to the Rhine, and the orders were we're transferring up to Patton's Third Army. They were getting done with the Battle of the Bulge. So we got up there, and we crossed the river at Mines on Pontoon Bridge, start chasing the Germans. There, by that time, they're pretty well whipped after Battle of the Bulge, but they were still in fighting mood. We medics never really knew where we were or what was going on. Our job was to focus on the wounded. The word medic hollered out was important to us. So
I bet you can still hear that sometimes.
Oh, I can. I can. And you know, I love the job because I was helping people. I was helping them.
Can you give us an example? Because most of us, Claire, you just said most World War II veterans even didn't see real combat the way you did in the infantry.
Okay. I will tell you this one story. It was getting towards the, probably in April or May, and we would fight with the Germans during the day, and they were retreating, and they'd get into a little village or something and dig in. And so then we would generally, maybe a day or so, would hit the village and try and clean them out. So we had the orders. We had run, they were in the village, we were out in the woods around. So we got the order, we were going to move out on them next morning at 7 o'clock. So 7 o'clock, a half-track reconnaissance vehicle for some reason got out in the road heading towards the village. We got hit by a projectile from a German 88, which was on a tank. They backed the tank into a building and put a camouflage net in front of it. Didn't see it. So they hit this reconnaissance vehicle dead center. Three guys killed, others wounded. So the medics had to go out and take care of the wounded, get them off the field back to the aid station. So the Germans did not shoot our medics. We did not shoot theirs. There was a deal during World War I that said, don't shoot the medics. But even so, we lost a higher percentage of medics than we did riflemen. We had to go out and take care of where they were. But anyway, get back on the line, and at 8 o'clock, Lieutenant Tarbell was second lieutenant, standing about 10, 12 feet on my left. So when it got 8 o'clock, he said, okay, guys, let's go get him. He caught a 30 caliber in his shoulder, broke his shoulder, punctured his lung. Well, he hit the ground. I was over there and saw what happened. We had tubes of petrolatum, Vaseline, and we put a circle of that around the hole. Put a piece of cellophane over it. If it came out the other side, we'd patch the other side too. Put a compressed bandage out. Didn't want the air to get into the lung cavity because it got in there, it's collapsed the lung, they died. You got to get that on there quick. So we got that all fixed up on him and sent him back to the aid station on our way. So the war went on. Then I had hepatitis, which affects your liver. And I knew I had it. Our doctor, we used to call him the vet, the horse doctor, because he was rough. I told myself, I got hepatitis. I'd lost about 20, 25 pounds. You know, at my weight, you don't lose that kind of weight. I was getting weak. So I was getting so darn weak that I couldn't even carry one end of a litter anymore.
And you'd probably contracted it from some of the people you were treating, huh? Or
taking care of? No, I think it was something we were eating.
Oh, okay.
Because we sort of lived off the land once we hit Germany. We'd catch a chicken. One guy went up in the attics of a barn and baby squabs down. I was a fisherman. I threw a hand grenade in the stream and pulled the fish out. And we were trying to cook stuff on our own. That's probably where it started. So anyway, went in the aid station. The doc said, Rasmussen, come over and help me. I need help. So he's working. The other guy's working there too, you know. And so I went over and helped him. And we had three or four litters on the floor and walking wounded. So he, exact words, he said, get the hell out of here and go out and find another doc. Well, do you believe in angels?
Sure.
I do. Okay. So we had set up, it's getting towards the end of the war, we'd set up the aid station in a building.
And he told you to get out of there because he could see the yellow in your eyes or in your flesh and saw how bad a shape you're in?
My blood, urine was like blood. Anyway, I walk outdoor down about six steps, start down the street. Here comes this officer towards me. Well, I was going to say, hey, doc, we need help. Because I could see his, on his lapels, he had the medical badge. But before I had time to say anything, he said, why in the aren't you in the hospital? You look like you're about dead. I said, I know, sir. This guy was a major. So I said, you're a doctor. I said, he won't sign me out. And I said, I'll fill out my book. He said, I can't do that. You're not in my outfit. He said, I'll see what we can do. So he said, you need help. Let's go. Went back, and he was working. We were working on this guy, and I went all the way over there. And he said to my doctor, he said, your guy has hepatitis pretty bad. Are you going to send him back? Yeah, I'm going to send him back. Of course, he's a major now, and our doctor was a first lieutenant. So that outranked him a few layers. So he kept at him. He said, boy, he's got it pretty bad. You know, these guys, you can die from that. Yeah, I'm going to send him back. So the doctor finally said, yeah, I'm sending him back soon. Well, I had a little book about, 3 by 6 inches that I wrote down the guy's name, his serial number, and all about when he was wounded. And that then had a hard copy that had a string on it. You tied on the button on the front of his shirt. That went with him back through the field, back through the different hospitals. So anyway, finally, our doctor, well, I'll send him back. So I took my book and filled it out, laid it on this guy's chest that we were working on, and handed him my pencil. He signed it. So I went out, picked up my personal stuff, went and got an ambulance, and headed back. Mm-hmm. Went back to a field hospital, and from there flown back to a big hospital in Paris. Boy, pretty beautiful. First 2 months on the line, no bath, no change of clothes, sleeping in the snow, sleeping in the mud, all that kind of stuff. We were dirty continually. Well, they didn't have any facilities to clean me up at the field hospital, and we had to wait about 2 days. Of course, being I was not critical as far as needing immediate help, they would send out the more severely wounded before me. Finally, they said, okay, get your clothes back on. My clothes were dirty. I take them off the head. They gave me a pair of pajamas and a robe. Nope, you can't take that. You got to leave it. So I had to put my clothes back on there. Got wet from the wet ground. I must have stunk to high heaven. So you get me on a plane, old C-47. Flew me back. Got off the plane. Cute little Red Cross gal came up. Oh, how can I help you? Is there anything you need? Well, I said, I haven't had a comb for about 2 or 3 months. She pulls a comb out of her little kit she's carrying with her. And she started to comb my hair. I said, he didn't get close to me. I probably smelled pretty bad. Oh, no, it's okay. So I went back to the hospital. We were isolated. They had 8 of us that had hepatitis in one room. We had our own dining room we went to. So I was there. Then the war was over about a week after I hit the hospital. And I was trying to contact my wife. Well, I contacted a Red Cross fellow, and he came up, gave me the information. So they would cablegram from Europe to USA, probably to New York, and from there, telephone down to Los Angeles, telephone down to Hawthorne. So I'd get a cable. It took about 3 days to get the message there and back. So I'd get a cablegram, bring it out to me, and no baby yet, everything's okay. Probably May 15th or 20th, something like that. War was over. So finally they said, well, you're okay, go back to your outfit. So I suited up, was heading out, and I had to change my money. The army made invasion currency because the German mark was not worth anything at all. So I had to change my French money into German money. So they had this little office, walked in there, and a lieutenant was sitting at the desk, and I laid my money on the counter, and he counted out and gave me the invasion currency. Well, he filled out a slip, he said, you have to sign this. So I signed it. He looked at it like that. I've seen that name someplace. Well, I said, you have? Yeah. He said, he lifted up the pad on his desk and pulled out a cablegram. The cablegram was following me. He opened it up. He didn't give it to me, just, you know, lieutenant and a private, and I was a corporal. He opened that thing up and read it to me. He said, "Oh, yeah, you got a baby boy. Everything's fine." I grabbed that darn cablegram. I headed for the door. And he said, "Hey, get back here. What's the problem?" He said, "You forgot your money."
You had something more valuable to you in your hand, yeah. Huh?
So anyway, back to my outfit. We started training to go to the Pacific. But you want me to give you a tragic story during the war? Injuries would go through our aid station to Field Hospital and back. And they sent the replacements back up through the same route. Getting towards the end of the war, three replacements came in. And they came down. They were sent to the sergeant in charge of the company. So he shook their hands and said, "Well, guys," he said, "you're in combat here." It was quiet right then. He said, "It'll get bad." He said, "I'm going to tell you exactly what you do and what you don't do. You darn well pay attention." So he said, "Number one, the password for the day," and this is the right one, was mustard cluster. He said, "If you go out someplace and somebody's standing, he says mustard, you darn well better say cluster." He told him about stay in your foxhole at night. If you have to go to the bathroom, he said, "Do it in your helmet, throw it over the side or whatever." He said, "But don't get out of your darn foxhole." He told him all this stuff they had to watch out for. It was all, you know, second nature for us. So it was getting pretty dark. So he said, this one guy, he said, "Okay, go down this street. There's buildings there." He said, "Stay on this side of the street and down at the corner. There's a guard down there. He's been on for 2 hours. You go down and replace him." These guys, they weren't paying much attention. I knew it because I'm a people person. You get to be a people person when you're in situations like that. So the guy took off down the street, sort of staggering along. It was about 100 yards down there, I guess. And we heard a rifle shot. "Medic," I ran down there. This guy was on the ground, dead. The guard on the corner had challenged him. He said, "Oh," he said, "I didn't know. He was all upset, you know." And I said, cool down. "What happened?" "Well, I said mustard, and he didn't reply. I said it twice. He kept coming. I shot him." "Well," I said, "you get that out of your mind as best you can." He said, "You did your job. You're right. He's wrong." So we hauled him off the field. Next morning, it was starting to get daylight, and you could just faintly see things moving around. And there were a few rifle shots going on one way or the other. And I heard "medic." I rushed over there, and here's one. There were three guys. The second guy was laying on the ground dead. He'd gotten out of his foxhole, and he guess he had to go potty, so he went around a bush, and he got between him and the enemy. Well, the guy, we figured it was probably a German with a night scope that can start shooting when it's still fairly dark. He shot him and killed him. So KIA, tag on him, hauled him out, by the side of the road or someplace, marked him. About an hour later, another shot on our side, in our place, again, "medic." I went over, and the third guy had laid his rifle right here, like that, and pulled the trigger. It took the bone right out of his leg. So I tourniqueted his leg, stopped the bleeding, got it all banged up so he wouldn't get dirt in it. Come on later, head him back to aid station. Well, he was screaming, crying, calling for his mother. He was just went psycho. A chaplain came over and was trying to talk to him. Three guys in less than 12 hours, three dead. Why? They didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I'm going to go back. I'm going to tell you this story while I remember it.
All right.
I'm teaching high school. Kids are going into the service during the Vietnam War. And I would tell my senior class, I'd tell them these stories. And I told them a story about the password. Oh, I don't know. It was about 15 years after this one guy had heard the story. He was now an adult. Probably, 15 years. He was probably hitting 30. I see him walking across the yard into my room. I recognized him. Came in. Shook his hand. "How you doing?" "Well," he said, "I got a story for you, Mr. R." "What's that?" "Well," he said, "last night I was going home from work. And I stopped at a little bar down here in Half Moon Bay. I sat down at the counter, and this guy sitting next to me looked familiar. So I said, 'Did you go to Capuchin High School?' He said, 'Yep, I did too.' So I said, 'I thought I'd try something on.' I said to him, I said, 'Mustard?' He said, 'Cluster.'" Just like that. 15 years after I tell him the story, he remembered. But that poor bugger overseas, he couldn't remember that for five minutes.
Yeah, I could see how that would stick.
Yeah. So anyway, the guys, the soldiers that we had, I'm sure it was the same way every place. The average soldier was great. They didn't complain. If they're wounded, you bang them up. If you had to leave them, they'd say, "Don't take my rifle," you know. They were really learned to be tough, and I admired them so much for that.
And you're helping us understand why that's the case. It's break time again. When we come back, an incredible coincidence, or was it? Out of more than 16 million Americans who served in World War II, Mr. Rasmussen's connection to one in particular provided him with an opportunity to help bring healing to a grieving family. This one might make your jaw drop just a little, and it might make your eyes water too. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the story of Alan Rasmussen, who is looking forward to visiting the National World War II Memorial this April with Central Valley Honor Flight, part of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. After serving in World War II, Alan, of course, couldn't wait to get home and see his wife, Millie, and meet their infant son for the first time. But he also had to take care of his discharge, and little did he know what amazing connection was about to be made.
They told me, go back to your draft board when you go home. So I walked down the same office, same little lady sitting behind the bench. Of course, I go in, big mouth. Hey, I said, you got me in here 2.5 years ago, and now you're going to have to sign me out. She gave me a big smile. Okay. So she pulled some papers out and got her pen in her hand, said, got discharge papers. I laid them on her desk like that. She pulled them over, tried to write. She had a big smile on her face. Smile started to go. She said, 71st Infantry? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, 66th Regiment? Yes. 2nd Battalion? I said, yes. She said, you knew the old Lieutenant Tarbell? I said, yes, I did. Do you know he was wounded? Yes, he was hit in the shoulder. Do you know he died? Yes, he died 3 days later in a field hospital. She picked up the picture on her desk and turned around and said, he was my son.
Gulp.
Gulp. Oh, so we had a little... few tears over that one. Anyway, she said, could my husband and I come up and visit with you? We'd like to hear more about what he did and what happened. Because all they did in World War II, we took their, well, I didn't, the grave registration did. They took their wristwatch, they took their rings, they took their billfold, and anything to identify them, they get and put in a little old bag like that and wrote a little letter, sorry to tell you your son was killed. And that they send them that. I take it to them and give it to them at the door. So anyway, they came up and we had a good talk about it. And I told them how brave he was, and he really was. He was front man off the line. They said, well, why don't you come down to our house sometime and visit? Okay, come down for dinner. Oh, another thing, what he was exactly my age within a week. He was a junior at UCLA. I was a junior at Santa Barbara. He made the big mistake. Well, I don't know if it was a mistake or not, but when you first go in, they'll say, who wants to go to Officers Candidate School, OCS? Well, he volunteered for that and became an officer, a second lieutenant. Well, anyway, so we had a real nice dinner, and over in the corner was a big, beautiful piano. Big, you know, flat one with a lid that lifts up and all that baloney. My wife played the piano professionally. So she went over to look at the piano. Well, Mrs. Tarbell walked over by the piano. And something seemed to be going on. My mind said, get your butt over there. So I went over there. And she was saying to Millie, my wife, she was saying, I have not played this piano since I got the letter that said my son was killed. I put my arm around her shoulder like that, and I squeezed her out like that. I said, Mrs. Tarbell, play the piano for me. She sat down and started to play the piano. She hadn't played the piano for over a year. And she played the piano.
A few tears, huh?
Yep, tears.
What did that mean to you? I imagine that had to be humbling to realize how unique an opportunity that was, how great the odds were against that coincidence. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't think it was a coincidence.
No, it wasn't. The Lord had me in his hand. I went through things that I don't know how I made it.
Can you share some of those with us?
Well, one thing I'll tell you, in the cowboy pictures, you know, when they shoot, the bullets go and they go zing like that. They don't go zing. They go by you, it's just a snap like that.
How close did they come to you?
I don't know.
Close enough to get your attention?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But they weren't supposed to be shooting us. But you see, when you're shooting, like with a machine gun, I saw more heroic things done by our soldiers. They didn't get any medals. This thing up here got a bronze star on it.
I see your bronze star okay. Right there, right below your combat medic badge. Yeah.
This was given to all combat medics. All combat medics were actually in combat were giving the bronze star. That's what they told me. They didn't come and pin on me or anything like that. Nothing that happened. So I got it.
But in your eyes, there were quite a few men who didn't receive something of that magnitude that deserved it?
Well, let me tell you one story. We were going for the city. There was an old runway between where we were in the woods and the town. And Patton wanted us to take that city and that runway so he could get his gasoline into his tanks. So now a machine gunner, light machine gun, that's the one that has the tube and the holes in it. There's a three-man crew. The guy that shoots the machine gun, the guy that carries the pistol for support and carries ammunition and feeds the belts into the machine gun for him, and a third guy that has buckets of those little rectangular boxes full of bullets. We're getting ready to hit this one city. And I'm standing by these guys. They're hunkered down there, and they got the machine gun. And I heard this guy say, okay, I'm going to run. You damn well better run with me, and if I run out of a belt, you're getting on stuck in there because we're going to get those damn crowds. So I'm standing there watching. I heard the word go. He jumped up. Boy, started firing that darn thing like that right across there. Not aiming anything. He's firing because the more you shoot, they hunker down so you can get across. Well, anyway, they made the cross. The guy was kept putting the belts in there. Belts are over there. I don't know, big long. They fold up inside that can. Now, he should have got a medal. We had one of our medics had glasses about that thick. Big guy, Jewish boy. And there was a guy wounded out there, and we got the orders. We do not have to go out under fire, heavy fire. But the guy did anyway. So the medic went out there, and he bent over, and all of a sudden he went over backwards like that. Guy walked up to me one time. Hey, Doc, I've been hit. Well, come on, you're walking. He said, my legs. I looked down on his legs. Hole, 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 hole. Seven holes in his legs.
Right across his thigh.
Right across. Yeah. What the heck happened to you? Of course, I cut his pants, and I was putting sulfur powder on it, and even no intensive bleeding, just bandaged it up. Well, he said, I walked down that darn street out there, and this crowd stepped around the corner, and he had a Schmeisser machine pistol, fires 1,200 rounds a minute. Sounds like ripping a piece of canvas.
The burp Rip gun.
Like that. Yeah, burp gun, huh? Anyway, I said, what'd you do? Took the old M1 up, and I killed him. Okay, that's what you're supposed to do. So I patched him up, and he was not really concerned. It hadn't hit the, you know, you have arteries on the inside of your legs, and the rest of it just didn't hit the bone.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy walked up to me and said, Doc, I've been hit. There's blood running down his forehead. Right away, I thought, a head wound, you know, better check it out pretty fast. Well, right across his forehead was just a groove. The skin was gone. You could see the skull, but it hadn't hit the skull at all. It just went through the skin. How the heck that happened? He said, I don't know. He said, I think it hit my helmet. It hit the little clip on his helmet where the chin strap goes under.
Yeah.
And had gone across his forehead and out the other side of the helmet.
It went parallel to the skull but didn't penetrate it.
Oh, I'll tell you another one. This got me just a little bit. We'd been doing some pretty heavy fighting. We were moving forward. There was a German soldier wounded down in a little ditch like that. So I didn't have anybody I was working on at times. So I went down there, and he was not too badly wounded, but he's lying there. And so I was working on him. And something... I just started to tingle. I looked around up above me, like above the door there. A rifle pointed right down at me like that, and I could see the top of a German helmet. I said to myself, wow, what's happening there? Because we were already going by. I thought maybe he'd just hit out there or something.
You're a sitting duck.
Yeah. So I thought, well, I'm going to stand up. I'm going to get him. We'll get it. So I stood up. His head was down, and he'd been hit and was dead. But that rifle was pointed right at me.
Ooh, that would get my attention, too.
Oh, yeah, there's lots. You try to forget a lot of these things.
And I get that, and I know our listeners do, but I think it's important for us to hear them so we know, so we appreciate the price that's been paid for our freedom, because it's not a small price.
No.
You mentioned getting home and meeting the parents of that Lieutenant Tarbell. Mm-hmm. You also had to meet back up with Millie and meet your baby for the first time. Tell me about that reunion.
Well, that was a high point. People say, what's a high point just as you are? Well, by the time I came across country, taxi cab out the house, I rang doorbell, the door opened, and here stood this. She was always dressed up nice, hair always nice. Here she stood with her little baby in her arms. She looked at me, I looked at her. Little guy put his arms out like that to me. She had our wedding picture, and she said afterwards, she said, I told him every day I'd show him that, that's your daddy, that's your daddy. Love your daddy. He was not quite a year old.
Not quite a year old.
He knew who I was. I found out about friends of mine who had been killed. My good buddy I went through college with, he died on a boat. He was going to North Africa to fight over there, and he died of something on the boat. Mm-hmm. Owen Sailing. The American Legion building in Chowchilla is named after him, the Owen Sailing.
Uh-huh. Whatever. When you think about those kind of things, the soldiers that you saw on the battlefield that
you couldn't help, that you couldn't do anything for, the people that you knew before the war that you came home and found out they didn't make it home. What did that tell you about yourself and how fortunate you were to be able to come home and see your wife and meet that newborn son who you'd never met before?
Well, I have always felt that the Lord has had me in his hand from the day I was born, because I've gone through things that I cannot explain how I made it. That's the way I feel about it.
I know you mentioned how that doctor who you felt was an angel sent you to the hospital to get the treatment you needed. But I also know it was pretty close to that time that your 71st Division liberated a concentration camp. Were you still with the division?
Yeah, we liberated two of them.
What do you remember about that?
We went into this concentration camp. The dead, they had piles of dead there. They had a trench where they're burying them. They had all, just like you see in the pictures. So the infantry guys were so angry. They were going to go in there's a village. They were going to go and shoot everybody in the village. I said, forget that. It's not the people there. It's Hitler that is doing this. The guys were begging us for food, and we were opening up our cans of sea rations and giving them the sea rations. But as soon as we got past the camp, the rear echelon jockeys came in, and they started bringing food in and all that stuff, you know. But, yes, it was just as bad. The smell was terrible. Yeah, it was not good.
Well, I want to say thank you for serving our country.
Oh, well,
thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything that we didn't hit on you think we need to know?
Oh, yeah, but so there's one. We had to take that village. There was a runway there. Old Patton, I got to tell you one more story about him.
Yeah.
We took the runway. We took the village. Every fourth tank or so has a bulldozer blade on it. They came in and filled up all the craters and went back and forth across them. By the time we got it packed down pretty well, here comes the C-47s. They land in there, and the tanks would come out of the wood and in underneath the wing, and they'd fill them up with 5-gallon jerry cans. They'd take off, and they'd come in and go. The British were on the north, and they moved slow. They had to stop and have their tea every afternoon at 4 o'clock, you know. And Patton was going. He really wanted to go. So they said you couldn't have gasoline. They stopped the tanks, can't have gasoline. He went back there. He drove up. I don't know whether he's in his Jeep or what, but he drove up. He said, I need gas for my tank. Well, sir, you can't have gas for your tank. We've been told you can't have gas. He turned around to the first guy in the truck. He said, it's just a wire gate. Gate went down. They went in and filled the trucks up. Second time I saw Pat, it was getting towards the end of the war. But it was still pretty cold. So we made do. Well, we didn't have really heavy clothes. We were always cold. So I'd found a piece of fur in a building that had been bombed out. It was about so long, about so wide. So I cut a strip off that. I sewed onto the collar of my field jacket, had it up around my neck. Well, not much going on. Here comes a Jeep down the road. I saw a flag out in front with three stars on it. Uh-oh, here comes Pat. Well, I was about as far as I hear the window there from the road. So I turned around. I hit an old salute like that, and I stood like that, you know. And he tapped his driver on the shoulder like that, and the Jeep stopped. I'm just frozen in space. He says, soldier, you're out of uniform. Yes, sir, but it sure keeps your neck warm, doesn't it, sir? He laughed. He had a fur collar, too. He said, carry on. Gave me a big smile and said, let's go. Yeah.
I doubt there are too many people who can tell that story.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the only other question I have for you, and maybe it's not an easy one, I think about your career as an educator and all the things you taught your students and even worked in some of your World War II experiences there. When you think about your children's generation, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and those generations, people who didn't live through World War II, what do you think we all need to know about what happened, why it happened, and what we can glean from it now?
I would be most happy if they seemed to want to know. But they seem to live in their own little world. And some of them don't change much from the time they're 14 until they're 40. They don't seem to want to know.
If they're listening to this, maybe they do. What's important for us to remember about you and those millions of Americans who were over there with you?
Every one of them that was in the Army, they were in for two reasons. Either they were drafted or they volunteered. But they were in the Army. So they had to do what they were told. We learned a lot. The frontline guys learned about combat. The backline guys learned about supply and so forth. They all had a job. Well, all supposed to have a job. The motto in industrial arts was learn by doing. In the classrooms, you learn by listening. People don't listen much now. Well, you learn under duress. I saw the fellows in the Army learn pretty rapidly. Learn by doing. I think the biggest problem we have is in our United States is people do not seem to want to learn what is true.
Well, hopefully we all listened and learned enough today to gain a better understanding of the price that has been paid and a little taste of what it meant to be a combat medic in World War II. He's Alan Rasmussen, 92 years old. You can see him in his cowboy hat at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Back next week with more stories from our greatest generation, but we're out of time on the show for today. I'm Paul Effler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. As is often the case, Mr. Rasmussen had a few more stories that wouldn't fit in to the confines of the radio time slot for Hometown Heroes. So if you're still listening, here are a few more stories from the memory bank of Alan Rasmussen.
I had made up my mind to go to college, and my folks, I don't know whether they didn't know how to handle their money or what, but they were always broke. So I decided my freshman year in high school I was going to start saving every bit of money I could because I wanted to go to college. My shop teacher in Chowchilla, I used to stay after school and work. He took me to his office and said, Alan, you'd make a good industrial arts teacher. Why don't you go to Santa Barbara and become an industrial arts teacher? Now, I was 14 years old, freshman high school. So I decided that sounded like great. So anyway, I worked my freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior year in high school. In August of 1939, I had saved my money in a little round coffee can. I cut a slot in the top of it. I took the lid off the coffee can, dumped everything out on the table, counted, I had $269. So I got all changed in the paper money, and the last day of August, my folks took me up in the car up to Atwater. I got a ticket in the Greyhound bus and headed for Santa Barbara. A friend of mine that had gone to school in Chowchilla, Owen Sailing, also was going. So we met down there. Here we heard a horn honk, and a big car slid to the stop by sight of us. You guys going to college? And we said, yeah. Young fellow said, well, I'm going to be a sophomore this year, so I was a freshman last year, and you're going to be a freshman? Yep. He says, I'll take you up, and we'll show you around. So we went on up to college, and I'd never ridden a car like that. It was just a limousine. It had a convertible with drop seats behind the front seats. So he took us all around the school, showed us where registration would be handled, and they just gave us a real good tour. He gave us one room where if you want the job, you come to this room because the lady here will get calls from people in the community and you can see her and get jobs to work if you have to work. So, okay, so we went down. We found a place to live about 3-4 blocks below the college. Well, we had a good place to live. I did, my buddy. But I ran out of money in about 2 months. What I did, I went to this lady in this room and she would give me places where I could call and go to work. And in those days, 25 cents an hour was a going wage for a college student doing gardening work such as that. Well, I worked at that, but I still wasn't doing too well and making enough money to live on. So I went back to see her again. She said, she called me. I was going by. She said, Alan, come over here. She said, I got a job for you. A lady just called across town. She wants a young fellow to live with her and work for his room and board. She has two boys. So I hiked across Santa Barbara 2 miles to where she lived. Two boys were standing out in the front yard playing football. So I played with them. They said, Mom will be home in a little while. So she came home and I introduced myself, took me in the house. And she had a beautiful room for me. So I said, hey. So she went and picked up my, helped me get my stuff, got down there. So I went on through college. And then December 7th, 1941. So I'm talking about it. And I made a big boo-boo though. Saturday morning, I was sitting out in the yard there, and the supply sergeant had a table out by his building there, and he had boxes with BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle. That's a hot weapon in the infantry, World War II. 20-round clip, fire semi-automatic or full automatic. So he was trying to get one apart. Well, dummy, I walked over to the table. I said, hey, Sarge, I'll help you. So we spread all the parts out, cleaned them all up. They had cosmoline on them. It's an oil grease they put on when they ship them. Cleaned it all up, put it back together, and slammed the bolt down. It worked fine. So he said, well, he said, I think I can do the rest of them now. So the next morning at Reveille, Sergeant said, Rasmussen? Yes, sir. He said, BAR man. Oh, I didn't want a BAR man. BAR man's life was very short in the Pacific. The old Japs want to get rid of you in a hurry.
Yeah, you're a target because you're the heavy weapon.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm sort of thinking, what the heck am I going to do? Well, I'm sitting out there talking to a buddy of mine. He said, Allie said, they need a medic up in the aid station. Week or two later, permission to go to New York and overseas. So they gave us a pass, a New York 24-hour pass to go any place we want and just get back to the ship. So I had a friend who told us that he was really knowledgeable about all of the bars in New York. He said, I worked there. He was an older fellow. He was in his 30s. Too old to be in the infantry, but he was in his 30s, or in the medics. Anyway, so we got to New York, went up. He got us on a double-decker bus. We're going down the street, and he said, okay, get off the next stop. Got off. Went down under the building. There's a bar down there. Walked in. Guy said, hey, Bill, how you doing? Great. So the guy said, the bar's yours. Anything you want. Well, I didn't drink. So we wandered around. He talked to people and went to another bar. Then we started going to big hotels. We went to the front of this big hotel. I don't know which one it was. I used to remember the name. Anyway, this guy at the gate out there, he was a whatever you call him, standing there in his uniform. So Bill said, I want to see so-and-so. He's the manager of this hotel. And the guy said, no way, fella. Can't see him. Bill said, you know how to use that telephone? Yeah. Pick that telephone up and call him and say, Bill's here. By golly, within 2 minutes, the manager of the hotel was out. Well, we were invited in. Bar's yours. And the guy said, do you want to need a room tonight? Well, if the vice president of the United States had walked in there and won the room, he couldn't get one. They were all crowded. But they saved one room for special people. We were special, I guess. No, we didn't want to stay overnight. So we go to another hotel, same thing, go in. And we're walking around, looking around. Bill's talking to people. And I heard somebody holler, hey, 71st, get over here. We had our uniforms on, the 71st patch on our shoulder. So we hiked over there, and it was a guy in charge of the regiment. Well, he was feeling a little good, and he was married to Guy Lombardo's sister, and they were having this big party to get him ready to go overseas. Well, of course, they had to all talk to us, and we were doing okay. So he said to this his wife, he said, oh, the guys need some money. We said, we don't need any money. So yeah, he said, give them some money. So she gave us each a $20 bill. Well, that was like big money in those days. So we go to Madison Square Gardens, and Bill starts around the side down the alley to the stage door. The guy said, get out of here, guys. You can't get in here. You got to go to the front door. And Bill said, is so-and-so still the manager of this place, Madison Square Garden? Yes, he is. I'll pick up that phone, call him, and tell Bill's here. Gave him a last name, too. Well, here comes a guy, head of the Madison Square Gardens out, shook Bill's hand, shook our hands, and said, what can I do for you? Well, he said, I'm going to go on home, and these guys would like to see the show tonight. Sonia Haney was doing the ice skating that night, her crew. So he said, okay. So Bill took off, and we went in the door and went through the girls' dressing room. Looked pretty nice. Anyway, we had the best seats in the house. So we stayed for that. That was where we headed back for the ship.
Well, did you ever figure out why Bill had so many great connections?
He knew them all.
He'd just been there that long.
Yeah,
right?
He'd been around. Well, he told us when, where are you from? I said, we're from Inglewood. I'm Inglewood. He said, well, you know where that big racetrack is out there? He said, when the war's over, I'm going to be head bartender in that racetrack. He said, you come over there and you'll have free pass to everything. Well, I never went over there. I wasn't interested in that. So anyway, there was a big convoy, and the convoys go to the speed of the slowest ship,
Right.
Well, on our starboard side, we had a big tanker. The tanker was loaded to the gills, and the ocean was rough, so he was probably doing maybe 5 or 6 knots. Well, the convoy went at that speed, so it took us about, I don't know, 12, 14 days to get across. So we stayed overnight, boat anchored, I guess, in the harbor on the south end of England. Then the next morning went over and hit the beach. Now, the landing on the beach were well past. We were late going over there. It wasn't like we were in combat then. So he put us up in this big field. There were 8-man tents.
You know, you mentioned guarding German prisoners, mm-hmm. or helping to run a camp full of SS troops. What kind of interactions with them did you have, and what kind of perspective did that give you on the enemy you'd been fighting all this time?
Well, these were the SS troops, and they were the Prima troops in Germany. Well, when the war was over, for me it was very easy to say the war's over. When we were down at Mittenwald, we had a chance to go hunting. It was against the law for anybody in Germany except the so-called elite to hunt. We would go out hunting, we'd kill a deer. In fact, the officer went out with an officer one time. He was a hotshot lieutenant, and he'd gotten a M1, and he asked, anybody here know anything about deer hunting? Yes, I used to hunt deer. Well, I'm going to get a Jeep. We're going to go. I said, well, bring a trailer, too, because if we get a deer, how are we going to carry it back? Oh, okay. So he got a trailer. So we take out, and I'm trying to tell him what he has to do and not do. He'd never gone hunting before in his life, but he had the rank, so he decided to go. So I saw some deer over, there's a little valley like that, and the deer were by the trees over in the other hill there. So I took a little rifle, and I cranked one in. Oh, I get the first shot. Okay, to myself, well, you're a lieutenant, I'm just a corporal, so go ahead. He got that rifle up there, he pulled the trigger and just click. He rammed the darn shell out, pull again, just click. Well, I knew what happened. It hadn't been clean.
Uh-huh.
So I said, well, sir, I said, deer are starting to move away. I said, I got to shoot. Well, go ahead and shoot then. So I knocked one down. I didn't realize they were elk, actually. And so we got this one that must have weighed about 300 pounds, 350 pounds. Deer will wear, depending on where you get them, they'll be anywhere from 100 pounds to 150 pounds. Mule deer will die, get a little more. But so we loaded this thing up in the trailer. He said, well, what are we going to do with it? Well, I said, I'll take care of it. We'll get it hung and cleaned and everything. Well, I gutted it. I feel gutted it. Cut his throat and bled it out and feel gutted it so we didn't have to carry all that stuff back in. Got it in the trailer. So we're living in this old German barrack. This is still down at Mittenwald.
Right.
And on the end of the barracks, there's a ramp that went down like that and made a hard left turn. Went under the building where they had their coal that they were burning in the fireplace and storage of everything. So we get there, and there was a German driver came out. I'll drive it. He spoke to me. I'll drive it. I'll back it down. So he tried to back that thing down that ramp and make that left turn. He couldn't do it. He tried about 4 or 5 times. So I just finally said, hey, Raus, get out. I'll do it. So I got in that thing. I looked out. I went down. I just watched it and started kicked the wheel a little bit, got the old tongue just right, and I got it done, back and forth, and I backed that thing right down around that corner. He spoke a little English. He was one of the SS troops. We'd take him out and have them do things for us. Well, how come, he said in broken English, how come? I'm a driver. I drive trucks. You're a medic. You drive better than I do. How come? Oh, I said, in America, we all know how to do things like that. You guys are backwards. But what I did, there's a lot of snow down there, and they had rooms full of skis that strapped onto your boots. Well, had the combat boots, which made pretty good base for them. So I went down, picked myself up a pair of skis, and I would ski as much as I could. Well, I stayed up in the aid station at night because I had another T5 with me. He's also a medic, and I had an ambulance with two drivers.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we needed somebody to, I didn't want to be cutting into this darn skin and out that there. So I went over to the, I was the only one that could go over and get into the prison. The medics could get in. So I went over and I said to the guy at the door, the gate, who spoke, they, someone spoke the language. I said, I need a butcher. Okay. Brought me out a butcher. I brought a rifleman with me. So we checked him out, brought him down the basement. He skinned out the deer. And then we had him come back and help us cut it up. What happened was the officers wanted all that meat.
Naturally.
I want some of it too.
You shot it.
So we had, I went down, I had to stay there 24/7. Unless it was during daytime, I'd get out once in a while. We had gotten this guy from the displaced persons camp. He was in his early 40s. He was a displaced person. He didn't want to go back to his country, so we had him come over. He was a cook. So we had a little kitchen there in the aid station, and he did our cooking for us. Well, I went down to the to see the chef. I said, hey, Doc, we need some food to cook. Well, hell, you just come down, eat down here with us. You don't have to have it. I'm on there 24/7. We got a little guy cooking for us. Well, I can't give you anything. A week later, guess what? He comes in, he's got the clap.
They needed your help.
So, I said, Cookie, I'll take care of you. I'll run the penicillin, 5 shots, every 4 hours. So, I said, well, there's 2 needles I can use. You're pretty heavy. I got to have one that'll go in quite a ways. So I kept a spinal needle in the autoclave. So when I was putting that penicillin in his butt, I put the spinal needle on. So I said, you know, Cookie, I still would like to get some food, some vegetables and meat and stuff that we can cook for us here. So I put that old spinal needle up, and I'm going for his butt like that. He's okay. You can have anything you want. Just come on down.
Just need a little convincing. Yeah.
I got along well with the Germans. After we were down in Mittenwald, I'd take my skis. I had a pair of skis. I'd ski out. They had a runway where they could fly light planes in, I guess, for officers and so forth. So I'd ski up the runway, and there are houses along the side of it. I'd just go over the house, take my skis off, lean them up against the wall, knock on the door, and they let me in.
Huh.
I could speak enough German by that time. I'd get along, you know. And I can remember this one house I stopped fairly often. What I did, I'd take a little bag, and I'd put about that much coffee in the bag. Went in, I'd say, make me some coffee. And I'll leave the bag. Anyway, but I got along well with this one house. I remember they had a fireplace with a big mantle up here, and they had pictures of these guys in uniform. Das ist mein Sohn, Kranken Ruski. He killed in Russia. Mm. And so I'd tell them about my family and all. I'd tell about my family, and I got along well with them. You know, the war's over.
Yeah.
Hitler was the guy. His village had been pretty badly shot up, and we went in this building, and there was a box about so big sitting there. I lifted it open. It was full of German money. So a big kick, you know, no fighting going on. It was quiet. So my buddy and I, we grabbed that box and put it on our arm, walked down the street. What are we going to do with all this German money? We didn't know. Well, here a little lady was sitting on the front steps of her house. Her house had been hit, was all damaged. And so she was saying, alles kaputt, alles kaputt, alles kaputt, alles wrong. So I walked up to her, and I looked at my buddy. He looked at me. I put the box in her lap and opened up the lid like that. And she said, for me? And I said, uh-huh. She got a smile that wide. I don't know if it was worth anything or not, but we gave her that darn money. Another sad one. I told you, fought down to the Rhine River. And it was heavily damaged because a lot of big industry was along there.
Mm-hmm.
So we came in at night under fire. Next morning it was fairly quiet. So my buddy and I are walking down the street. There's a German guy standing in the doorway. Come here like this. walked over and he pointed at the ground. There's a woman's arm sticking up out of the dirt like that. She said, "Das ist mein Frau." That's my wife.
Things you can't unsee, huh?
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope, you can't unsee those. Don't think about them too much, but I found out about friends of mine who had been killed. One guy flying P-38s was messing around. He was they fly so many missions, then they get time off.
Right.
Well, the story I heard was that the replacements came, and he was going to go up and show off a little bit to them. So they were up chasing one another up in the glider, just flying around. And for some reason, he put the nose of that 38 down towards the ground and opened those old Allisons wide open. The fuselage in the center, twin booms, horizontal stabilizer.
Right.
Creates a vacuum. It will create a vacuum, and they can't pull out. You can't pull that darn plane out.
So he went right in.
He went right in the ground. Oof. Another friend of mine got killed also in the fighter plane. A friend of mine from college was, he was the leader of Torpedo Squadron 8. You may have heard about them.
Ensign Gay was the lone survivor.
You yeah. got that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he was the leader of that squadron. I don't know how many there were in the squadron. Any idea?
No, but I'm interviewing a guy from that squadron next week.
Okay.
Because he was grounded a couple days before because he was sick and couldn't fly with him.
Oh,
he good. Lives right here in town.
Well, just tell him the Lord had him in his yeah. hand. They're going low level. Our torpedoes were so inaccurate that they would get as near the ships as they could. Well, the Japs put their guns right down. So as I heard it, this man here, he was in it. He'll know for sure. You can check it.
Yeah.
Every plane was shot down. There was only one survivor.
Yeah.
They found him floating on some thing there.
Yeah.
And yeah, I knew the guy. He was in college with me, the leader of the squadron. Another one, a friend I knew well, took off from L.A. I don't know the story for sure, but some way he got up over the mountains, and he went down in the snow. Now, I remember the story, how true it is, and he was killed. The guy from went to high school with another guy was killed. He was a pilot. How did I feel? Well, I try not to let it tear me apart because I saw in combat soldiers that were changing their whole lifestyle and looking to the Lord for help. Now, I don't know how well they were with the Lord. I don't know. But I know I would visit with them as I was working on it. And they say there were no, what do you call them, foxholes.
Yeah, no atheists in
no
foxholes.
No atheists in foxholes. They said that. And we, the chaplain we had was a Catholic chaplain. But he took care of us. You know, they had, I guess they had Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant chaplains.
Right.
And they took care of us just like we'd ever asked. I know the one we had was Catholic, but he'd give communion, and I was right out there getting mine. He was a great guy. He was brave. He came in whenever we had somebody down that was, well, anytime, but if it was a serious one, he was right there talking with them. Yeah, he was brave.